Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our guest on this episode, James Jeffers, could pinpoint the exact moment he knew farming was the career for him following military service. It came after a retreat with the Farmer Veteran Coalition, and in the car ride home, Jeff looked over at his soon-to-be co-founder Steve and said, "We're going to be freaking farmers!" James Jeff Jeffers is the co-founder of a nonprofit based in Dallas, Texas called FARM, Farmers Assisting Returning Military. Jeff and the team at FARM are dedicated to providing military veterans with internships, educational opportunities, and hands-in-the-dirt experience through a variety of agricultural settings. Jeff grew up outside Indianapolis, playing in the woods, and eventually falling in love with the outdoors through hunting and fishing. After high school and a brief stint working in Florida, he fell victim to one of the Army's 1990s Be All You Can Be television ads and literally signed up the next day. This began a multi-year, multi-deployment experience with the U.S. Army Infantry starting before 9/11 and encompassing several deployments to Iraq during the height of the fighting. After several close calls with enemy grenades and a car bomb, Jeff was medically retired with a traumatic brain injury and began the fearful and uncertain, his words, journey of building a life outside the Army. This episode is all about that journey and Jeff's passion today for helping veterans in agriculture. He provides some of the most practical and down-to-earth advice for military veterans looking to get involved in ag that I've ever heard. If you're interested in starting farming after the military, then this episode is a must listen.
My dad was Navy. He was actually on the Parchee, which they just released information about that a few years ago.
The Parchee? What is that?
It's a submarine. He was on the subs.
Got it.
So he was in satellite communications, but yeah, it's a pretty interesting story behind that. And then my grandpa was Army as well, and then my uncle was Air Force and flew the bombers, and then flew some like test planes for jets that we can't remember exactly right now. But I've got quite a bit of military background. But as far as me personally, you know, it's weird as a kid. You know, watching different military movies and stuff, we'd go out in the woods and crawl around through the creeks in our camos and all that stuff from the Army Depot. But as I became a teenager, I was more of an anarchist. If you told me I was going to be working for the government, let alone leading 9 guys through an urban environment on the other side of the planet and getting them home alive, I'd have laughed at you and said you're crazy. But and I was kind of a shy kid too. So, but what got me into it, I guess, I moved away from Indiana pretty early age, 16, 17, moved to Florida, became a beach bum, worked at the t-shirt shop, spent several years there, was dating a gal, and was working for her dad after I got out of the t-shirt shop doing carpet, which was horrible. And I fell victim to the 80s, 90s ad campaigns from the Army. I was sitting there watching a Miami Dolphins football game, and a commercial came on and Scuba Steve came up out of the water with a rifle and said, "Earn 20 grand for college and be all you can be." And I just kind of looked around the room and surveyed my environment and was like, the very next morning I was at a recruiting station and signed up for infantry. And within a week I was at Miami MEPS.
Wow. How old were you at the time?
I was 25 at that time. I went in late, which was good for me because while I was in Florida, I was getting a lot of stuff out of my system. Right. And I went in quite a bit more mature and, you know, really with the mindset of just being a sponge and absorbing as much information as I could. And that's what fast tracked me. That's what, and I also just falling into, I guess, what I was born to do. I was lucky in that aspect where I was just really meant to be an infantry guy, I guess, but I loved it. So yeah, got did my basic in Benning in Georgia. I know all the bases have changed names now, and I don't know what they are. But for
Neil
me,
Benning.
for me, it was Benning, and then I was supposed to be airborne and jumping out of planes in Italy, Vicenza, and that got messed up in my contract, like it happens to some people, and I ended up mechanized in Texas with 1-9 Cav. Most people will know that unit from Apocalypse Now, the Kilgore and the surfer guys in the helicopters. So that was my unit. Obviously they traded in the helicopters for Bradley's. But I was devastated. I did not want to be in Texas, never having been here. And I definitely didn't want to be riding around on a battlefield in a tin can. So but after getting here, well, so I got to Fort Hood and was depressed. It was literally, I thought it was like the ashtray of the world. And and again, not wanting to be around the Bradleys. But as time went on, the co-founder of the organization was my next door neighbor in the barracks. And those guys all took me down to Austin, and then I saw the Hill Country. And being a hiker, I hiked all of Texas for the most part and fell in love with it. And we used to go down to Austin and listen to blues music and stuff. But so I really learned to love it. And then I also learned to appreciate the Bradleys the more I worked with them. You know, that's an amazing support by fire when you really need it, especially when we were deployed. So yeah, so I went in, and what year was, I went in, I guess it was late 99. I guess I was in by 2000. So I got stationed down here in 2000, and then obviously a year later, September 11th, and then we were on some kind of cycle where we were QRF. So we were actually stood up to be some of the first to go in. We did not, within the amount of time it took them to get the logistics all figured out, that cycle changed over to another unit. They were the ones that actually went. I didn't deploy until 04. So I did my first deployment 04 to 05. I was stationed over there in the Alshueta province, which was predominantly Haifa Street and Talal Square. Most people probably know that from the Battle of Haifa Street. But it was basically right outside the green zone. We were stationed at Bob Headhunter, outside of, I think it was gate one of the green zone. But yeah, that first deployment was crazy. We were helping stand up the first Iraqi National Guard units, which ended up being guys just piling in from the neighborhood that wanted to keep their neighborhood safe. So those guys were great. We did a lot of patrols with them, just showing them the ropes, and then, you know, left seat, right seat, ride. They took over, and we'd go out with them. But yeah, they could do a lot of stuff we couldn't do. And then also they, you know, it's their neighborhood. They see things that are wrong with their neighborhood before we see them, even though people that aren't supposed to be there, and you know, things like that. So it was pretty exciting. We also got really lucky early in that deployment. We had a couple special forces guys working in our area, and they needed a platoon to help conduct raids on some of the higher value targets they were looking for. So they took us on one, loved how we operated, wanted us to help them the rest of the deployment. So that was probably the funnest times over there. I mean, it was great. We still had to do our regular, you know, patrols and all the BS, but it was great to have that opportunity to go with those guys and really feel more like you're making a difference, you
How
know, getting.
much were they using tanks in that capacity at that time?
I didn't see a tank at all on that first deployment, but it was, we were in a very built up area. So they kind of didn't apply on our first tour. It's funny you brought that up. I'll get to the tanks here shortly. But yeah, so we worked with those guys a lot and continue to do our regular patrolling. We didn't lose too many individuals on that first tour. Me and my squad got blown up by a car bomb, and we were lucky enough to be inside the Bradley. It totally disabled the Bradley, but it saved us, knocked us all out for a bit, detached my squad leader's retina. He's blind in one eye now. And then later in that deployment, we kind of had a curse where we had a lottery where you get, you know, draw out of a hat to get your 2 week R&R to go back home. And every time someone's name got called, you pretty much could set your watch by it. You're going to go out in sector and get hit. So sure enough, I came up on leave, went out, took three grenades in an alley, Area 5 up by Haifa Street, and, you know, went home, went on leave to, I think we went to Mexico. So, but yeah, so came back, our unit 19 disbanded. And they took half to Fort Bliss and half somewhere else. They attached us to 18 tankers. It was a tanker unit. That was not great. Those guys really didn't know how to use us. The actual tanks that got attached to us when we deployed, those crews, those guys were amazing. But as a battalion, it wasn't the best of times. So my second deployment, 06 through 08, was very much different than my first deployment. We were more in vehicles, doing route clearances. We were basically following three supply chains up north that were coming down through Syria. And this was about the era they switched from IEDs to EFPs, which were the penetrators, the copper slug mm-hmm. penetrators. So we were pretty much almost burned down a whole company of Bradleys and quite a few Humvees. Not all of them burned to the ground, but we went, there was one time where we had very few vehicles just because they were all, you know, being repaired and under maintenance from getting blown up. So we worked our way up north. We were originally in Bob Rostamaya and worked our way up to Cop Hope, which was a forward base right outside of Sadr City. And they were building the Iraqi army barracks just outside of that operating base. And there was a retired, I think he was a Delta Force guy, retired Delta Force guy. He had like six or seven BG security dudes with him. And they would basically go out and recruit guys from the area to come in and work on building these barracks and pulling outer security. So we were a smaller base within a larger base that was being built, and it was good and bad. I mean, you slept with your rifle closer to you because you knew these militia guys were right outside your gate. But at the same time, we didn't deal with rockets or any of that stuff because they're not going to rocket their own guys. So that was kind of refreshing. But yeah, just a very different deployment. Just dealing more with it got so bad because there were so many choke points and only a few routes to get back for resupplies. They started bringing in Black Hawks and just shuttling us back and forth to get refit. But yeah, that was over in 2008. That was a 15-month deployment. We got extended on that. Yeah, that was rough. So I came home. I was struggling. I really didn't know what was going on. I couldn't even make coffee. I would brew water or put the grounds in. I forget to put the water in. After like three coffee pots later, I'm like, okay, something's going on with me. I got to find out what's going on. I would read paragraphs of stuff and just not have any clue what I just read. And after all the explosions over those two deployments, they determined I had traumatic brain injury. And, you know, back then while we were deployed, they really didn't know anything about that stuff. They're like, take Motrin and drive on, right?
Right.
So, that was about the time they were realizing, okay, you know, this stuff's doing damage. So I went to a medical hold unit. I was trying to stay in because I was a lifer, man. I loved what I did. I enjoyed it, even the worst of it. It was just awesome. I couldn't imagine doing anything else. So I tried a couple different programs. One of them was COAD. Don't ask me what that stands for. But the Army had a program where they would try and place you in a position that caters to your injuries. And so I actually found my dream job. I would be a sergeant first class, but operating more like a warrant officer. I'd be my own boss at a guard unit. And I would go into this guard unit every day and build and facilitate trainings for the commander and the guard unit when they come in. And I would mostly be doing, mount training, and reflexive fire ranges, which I was pretty much already doing for 1-9 anyway. I was running a lot of those ranges anyhow. So it was great. I was like, that's perfect. And the problem was, it was a 4-year commitment, and they could only guarantee me 2 years in that position, and then I'd be needs of the army. And I just didn't want to end up in an office pushing paperwork for some colonel at TRADOC or something. I was like, that's not for me. I wouldn't make it. So I opted out, and so they medically retired me, and that's pretty much when the fear set in, because I had no clue what I was going to do. Like I said, I really, really loved everything I did while I was in. But because I was getting a medical retirement, I had a little bit of flexibility, and I was still in the medical hold unit for maybe a month or so before I was ACAP and get out. So it gave me time to really sit and think about what it is I am going to do. Because again, I was scared shitless. I didn't know. So I sat and stewed on it. And going back to where I started, I was big into the outdoors. I knew I wanted to do something with the environment and be outside. So at the time, my co-founder Steve, who was my next door neighbor in the barracks when I got there, he had gotten out and was already living in Dallas. And at the time I was doing research, Cedar Valley Community College up here in Dallas was one of the few colleges that was offering any kind of community building courses. So I wanted to do stuff with like geothermal and solar for houses. So I came up, went to school for that. I also figured, if I couldn't make ends meet off my retirement, I could always work with Steve. He was a three-part owner of a foundation company, so I could do side work if I needed to. So moved my family up, went to school, and at that time I was eating, excuse me, I was eating organic, trying to be healthy and fix my system. So the next step was for me to start growing my own food and getting it even fresher, right? So I came up, and Steve was already planting his yard and edible landscape. His theory was, if I'm going to spend $20 on a tree, I might as well get a peach tree and feed my kids, So he helped me tear up my yard, put in a garden, and absolutely fell in love with it. It was everything I needed. I was learning something new every day for my brain injury. It was getting exercise. I could stop when I needed to and start back up when I needed to, just with physical injuries and stuff. But I just loved it. It was very therapeutic and rewarding. And so we started tearing up our friends' yards and just expanding, and then we'd get empty lots around Dallas. Before you knew it, we had eight plots we were working in Dallas. And we were going to the restaurants, collecting their compost waste, bringing it back to those plots, breaking it down on site to grow vegetables to sell back to them later. And it was fun. It was a lot of work. I ended up being more of a composter and compost pickup guy than a farmer at that point. And driving all over, it just consumed a bunch of time, and driving to different plots and managing those different plots took up a lot of time. So at the time, I was separating and getting a divorce and moving out, and I stumbled on a 16-acre farm that had a large facility where we could house veterans. And actually, I skipped forward a little bit. So during that time, we were selling to the restaurants and doing all that. We started finding out a lot of guys from our unit were committing suicide. And then eventually started hearing about 22 a day and the 22 kill campaign. The 22 kill guys are here from Dallas. And we knew a lot of those guys too. And we're just kind of like, why isn't anybody doing anything about this? And we're like, okay, well, we're somebody. We can do something. And I didn't know what it looked like at first. I don't know anything about nonprofits. I was just trying to piece something together out of desperation. And I just figured it would look like, fire pit night, getting vets together and, having some beers. Well, there was already an organization basically doing that. And it was called Camp Valhalla. This is years and years and years ago. They may still be around, I don't know. But I knew at that time, while I was playing around with the ideas of what it would look like, I knew I wanted to incorporate the agriculture aspect of it because, again, it was so therapeutic and rewarding work for me, and I just wanted to pass that along. Also, while we were working those smaller plots, we'd have veterans coming up to us saying, "Hey, man, I want to come volunteer." And we're like, "We're not a nonprofit, man. We're a for-profit." And they're like, "I don't care. I want to come hang out and work." So they would. And I noticed, while they were doing that, guys would be picking weeds literally within, 10, 15 minutes of, who were you with? Where'd you go? Where'd you deploy? They just start opening up about their trauma and the stuff that they'd been through. Whereas those guys probably were going to counselors for 2 or 3 years and probably not said much or brought up much, maybe, I don't know. But I could tell there was something there, besides it just being rewarding and therapeutic in and of itself, that getting back around other veterans who have shared experience, even if it's across across branches, like there's always a branch rivalry when you're in, right? I've noticed when I'm out, it doesn't matter. I don't care who you're with or what you've been through, what you've done, or it's just there's more of a camaraderie when you're out here on your own in civilian life. You need those bonds with people. We've gotten a pretty diverse mix. So anyway, yeah, I incorporated the agriculture in there, and we lost two guys back to back weekends. And I wasn't ready yet. And I just said, screw it, I'm gonna launch it. And we launched it, and I somehow finished up the paperwork and got it filed for our EIN number or whatever.
By launched it, you're talking about Farm, Farmers
Yeah,
Assisting Returning
yeah,
Veterans, the
farmers.
nonprofit.
Yep, sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. So we launched it again out of desperation just to try and have something going. And we ended up on that 16-acre farm with an opportunity to house veterans, and we started a internship. It was a 6-month internship, and our farming was mostly focused on high intensity vegetable production for basically market farming. And but the nice thing about that farm is it had a little bit of everything. It had tilapia for aquaponics. We were growing with fish and water systems. It had hydroponics. We had chickens, sheep, goat. We brought in large black hogs, heritage hogs. They were great. We had a little representation of everything there on the farm, which was nice in the beginning. Guys that come in and we'd be focused on vegetable production and microgreens production and all that. But we had guys come in and they're like, "Man, I just love feeding the chickens and taking care of the chickens." So it gave guys an opportunity that don't really know much about agriculture to come in and kind of sample various things and decide what they wanted to do. So it worked out great. The communal housing situation didn't. We're not counselors, and I'm not a den mother, so it was kind of rough, managing the living situation. So I don't think we'd go down that road again, and haven't. But we do now. We have tiny homes and stuff where we have flexibility and opportunity. If a veteran is interested in something that we're not fully versed in, like say raising bison, we have a tiny home we can drop on a partnering farmer's farm, and he can go live in this tiny home and intern with someone who's already doing what they're interested in. We don't do that often. It's very unique scenarios that fit together like that, but that is another option. But basically what we do is dirt therapy. We bring veterans in, get them into agriculture, and try and help them as best we can to get started, whether it's writing business plans or going out to their property and helping them develop a plan and set up. In fact, that's where I'm leaning nowadays. I'm getting further away from, vegetable production, which is great. I believe veterans are a great fit to replace the dying farmer. And I think it's important to feed people and to rebuild localized food security, which we don't have. I'm leaning more the further I go back to my roots of I just want to fix land. So I'm getting more into restoration agriculture, permaculture, you know, I want, my goal is to get in a position where I can go camp out on veterans' properties for a couple of weeks and help them develop a full-on plan, not just of what they want to accomplish, but building those farms out in ways through earthworks and waterworks to make those farms more resilient. And I mean resilient in all capacity, both, you know, mainly for the environment. You know, we're in Texas. It's freaking hot here in the summer. Not much grows. There's lots of drought. You know, I want to be able to teach these guys how to hold the water on their farm and distribute it where they need it and keep that water capacity. So that's where I'm leaning towards now in the future. That's in the works.
It's a really interesting progression, right? And I think, and I wonder if that has to do with, as some of these conflicts come to a conclusion over the last couple of years, you have less of a need perhaps of veterans transitioning out directly and in search of what that next chapter looks like, and more of veterans who have already started that process, perhaps through Farmer Veteran Coalition, who are now past the foundation and are saying, there's a lot of chatter over here about regen ag and sort of this holistic management. Now, how do I do this aspect of it? So because of your experience doing it yourself and in smaller plots, it almost seems like now you're poised to take the next phase of transitioning veterans as they built their agricultural foundations and teach them this new technique, if you will. I mean, is that at all sort of resonate with some of the either timeline or paths or strategies that you've seen from the veterans that you've interacted with?
Yes and no. So like you said, the transitioning veteran coming out, that's an important piece. And a lot of us working with restaurants and local chefs, that was a huge piece that I didn't really touch on. You know, the food community, foodies and chefs really do care for the most part about, you know, where their food comes from and want to have those relationships with the farmer. So for me, I hate to say stepping stone, but that was a great stepping stone for me easing my way back into society. Cause a lot of us, you know, especially a lot of combat veterans, they come back and it's just, you know, you have a lot of disdain for civilians, and, you know, working alongside them and that exposure, especially to people who, you know, are like-minded, it just kind of eases that transition. So while I did struggle, I didn't struggle a lot. That disconnect for me didn't last very long. So I think it's important to still capture those veterans as they're transitioning and get them set up where the gray area is between that and a veteran who already owns their own property and helping them expand on these regenerative practices. The difference is one owns land and one doesn't. And land access is a very real problem right now. We've struggled with land access as an organization. I'm not going to get into all that, but for a guy coming, you know, unless you're born into the farm, the family farm, and right, you know, whatever acreage that is, you know, great, that's an awesome opportunity for you. But someone coming out of the military, you know, regardless of their financial situation, it the price of land is just unrealistic right now.
Absolutely.
For anyone to limit, well, it is unrealistic, but it's even more so unrealistic for someone wanting to do an agriculture endeavor, because the odds of you making that whole are slim to none, unless you're, you know, there's a very small handful of farms, I would say, that are, you know, 5 acres or less or 8 acres or less that are producing, you know, 300,000, 350,000 a year, you know. So it's going to be difficult to fit that note on your land alone. So yeah, so that's kind of where we're at. I still want to capture the guys getting out, and that's great that they like to come and participate. Maybe some of them want to start a business, maybe some of them just want to be more sustainable and feed their family. But there's also these guys, you know, that have already made the decision to commit to, this is going to be my career. And I'm glad you brought up the Farmer Veteran Coalition, I didn't mention, you know, those are the guys that truly convinced me and Steve to be farmers. We were sort of, I guess, even though we were selling to restaurants and producing on a small commercial scale, you know, we looked at ourselves basically as hobby farmers. You know, I would tend to my garden in my backyard more than I'd be concerned about any plots, or, you know, the chefs were pretty lenient as far as, you know, what we brought. I was pretty blasé about it, you know. But these guys that or the Farmer Veteran Coalition. So back in the day when we first started that, I think the Farmer Veteran Coalition had only been around for about a year. Mm-hmm. And they were doing these weekend retreats, you know, be like a 4-day retreat or whatever. So we would go on these retreats. They'd fly you in, or you could drive in, and we went to like Philadelphia, Ohio, Kentucky. We went to a couple different ones, and they were amazing because you would go and you would tour over the weekend, like 8 different farms. And in the evenings, they would collectively pull produce and meat from these farms and put on this big elaborate dinner in the evening, farm table dinner. They would have educational classes and things like that. And it was crammed into 4 days. But the most valuable thing from it that we took was we got to interact with the farmer, and we could see the ones that were struggling and what they were struggling with. And we could see the ones that were successful and what aided them in being that successful, and having that interaction and that time to ask the questions we had, and really get a feel for, you know, what does it actually look like to be a farmer? Cause some of them were really struggling, and you know, it's difficult work, and it's a difficult decision to make. But I think it was after Philadelphia or after Kentucky, I can't remember. We were driving back to Texas, and we're just like, we're gonna be freaking farmers.
Wow.
It affected us so much that we're just like, you know, what else am I gonna do, right? And I love this so much. Why not just pour the rest of what I have into feeding people and growing the healthiest crops I can grow?
How are you guys finding veterans to come and participate in the 16-acre plot now? What's that outreach process look like? And
so we don't have that 16-acre farm anymore. We've jumped from farm to farm right okay. now. So our internship brings veterans in. A lot of workshops bring them in, mostly word of mouth. People, you know, and then people will follow us on social media. But keeping that relationship with the FBC, you know, that, I don't know if people realize there's 4,000 veteran farmers in Texas alone. So, you know, that is a huge resource for my organization to be able to go help those veterans. But another thing that I haven't done yet that I'd really like to do is get into the bases. And they have programs where you can stand up and speak in front of veterans that are about to get out that maybe or may not know, you know, what they're going to do. And I would love to go talk to those guys about agriculture and get them into farming and talk about our organization. So,
yeah, that's a really important point and place to try to meet those folks, yeah. Right? As essentially all options are open. Mm-hmm. And just through doing this podcast for the last couple of years, I've learned that the scope in which transitioning veterans think about agriculture is often pretty small, right? I can either or only be an actual farmer, right? Or I can only do the things that I did in the military, supply chain or logistics in ag, right? And to the point you made earlier, which I also thought was a fantastic point, which was if you do choose to get out and actually farm for a living, that's not always an easy transition, nor is it always an easy process, right? It can be very tough to be profitable, let alone whether you're being profitable on your own land, right? Are you buying your own farm? Are you leasing it? Are you stepping in and managing somebody else's farm? I mean, these are all big early decisions that, like most veterans, they either jump in with both feet up to the waist, right? And sometimes that doesn't always work out. So I always like when folks talk about the sort of thoughtful ease transition into these kinds of big decisions that are potentially financially expensive. And if you can start to plant the bug as early as we used to call it SEPs or TAPs, like separation. Again, I don't remember the acronym either, but those sort of transition classes, that'd be a wonderful place to get into as early as you could. How does that work? Is it something you apply to do? How do you start to get into that?
I think you just have to reach out to whoever's in charge of that program on the bases. And there's another program, the name's escaping me right now. It's a transition program where you can actually, you'll still be active duty and you're able to go work somewhere.
Skills Bridge program. Yeah, it's amazing now.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Fantastic.
And that's even better going back to your point of, you know, just jumping out and you know, how is it financially feasible now that, you know, if you don't have any kind of retirement and you're transitioning to the VA system or whatever you're doing, you jump out, it's a huge upfront financial burden to kickstart a lot of this stuff, unless you're lucky and you just find land where you could drop seed in the soil and it'll grow with no attendance whatsoever. Then God bless you. But yeah, you know, that's not how it is here.
That's right. Not a lot of places in Texas you can do that.
No, it's mostly limestone and a little bit of dust on top of it. And you've got to build soil here. And it's work and it takes time. It takes about 3 years to get soil where it needs to be at the depth and structure and holding capacity and all the microorganisms. It takes time to build all that. And that veteran transitioning out may not have that time. That's why I always tell people, or I quit telling veterans, do a business plan, because no one ever listens to me. Who wants to sit and do a business plan? It's god awful. But I tell them now, I'm like, if you're not going to do a business plan, at least do the market research part of it and the financials of it, and learn how to budget and what, not just budget and what your ongoing costs are, but what is your upfront cost and what is that return on investment? Because that, you know, if it's 5 years, it's 5 years. 5 years you're working, you're not going to have much profit. You're paying off whatever you borrowed to get the equipment you need. And you don't need a ton necessarily. It just depends on what kind of farming you're going to do. If you're going to do small backyard, you know, spin type farming, small plot intensive, commercial growing on an acre or less or 2 acres, you don't need a ton of tools. I mean, you can, you know, if you don't mind running a broad fork and shoveling, you know, you're good. You can get some hand tools, wheelbarrows, a broad fork, and some seeders, and that's not terribly expensive. And you could potentially be producing, you know, quite a bit of stuff. And if you're resourceful too, which most veterans are, you know, you can source wood chips, which will break down into soil over time. You can source, you know, all kinds of stuff, food waste. We went to juice bars, and that stuff's beautiful, man. Pulped down, you know, vegetable and fruit waste, and that stuff breaks down fast. So, you know, if you're resourceful enough, you can build the soil quickly and do it with minimal tools and upfront costs. But you have to know that market. You have to know your market. You just do that. You know, we've had guys that are like, oh, because we used to grow microgreens. Oh, I want to grow microgreens. He's in a rural, very rural area. Those people aren't even going to know what a microgreen is, let alone pay the exuberant price that they pay.
Right.
So you got to know your market, you know. In rural areas, you're going to be better off growing staple crops and things that, you know, people are used to. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not telling those people for not knowing, you know, it's the cities that have the designer chefs that have that force trends on certain types of produce and products. So, you know, just know your market. And once you do, you know how much you're going to make. You know the restaurants in your area, if that's the route you're going to go, and you'll know what they want and what you can provide them. I mean, you can seek out an Italian restaurant or a pizza shop and grow mostly basil and probably make ends meet,
right,
and diversify however you need to after that. So it's just a matter of knowing your market and having those financials and tracking every bit of it. So that when you do have your investment paid off, then you really know how much you're profiting and whether it's feasible to keep the lights on and pay the house, you know?
Those are probably two of the most important points to make for an early veteran as they come out, right? Can you do it financially? And if so, what is it going to look like over how much time? And are you creating something either unique, differentiated, or that has a real need in whatever community you're planning on selling on and into, recognizing you're somewhat bound in some cases by where you are?
But going back to what you were saying about transitioning out, even before having a business plan and all that stuff, I highly encourage, you know, if you're going to get out, maybe you've got to get a regular job. I would say tear up your backyard, start as a hobby gardener, learn how to grow the vegetables first or whatever. Or if it's chickens, figure out how to operate it. And then, you know, and then that's the weird gray area, right? Is transitioning from this cubicle job or whatever, Home Depot or whatever you're doing, to full-time farming. And that's just a matter of scale, just putting it to scale. So that's where the financials and all that come in to get you where you need.
Jeff shares some harsh realities in this episode about his own struggles with getting farms started, but also what it can be like for military veterans getting into agriculture for the first time. I think it's important to hear both the good and the difficult from those who have experienced it. But Jeff does an excellent job describing what interested veterans should focus on at the beginning of their farming careers. Start small in your own backyard. Avoid expensive upfront capital investments. Know your market and where you fit in that market, and keep ruthless track of your expenses and profits. While there will always be pivots, it was clear from my conversation with Jeff that he never lost the passion for helping veterans find the same healing benefits from agriculture that he did. So if you're interested in learning more about farm, please visit their website at farmingveterans.org. They're also on Facebook and Instagram. You can also reach out to their executive director, Hyatt, at hyatt@farmvet.org.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike DeSa, and until next time, stay frosty.